The popularity of cat videos on the internet should tell us all we need to know about our desire to get laughs in short bursts. Before cat videos, there were cartoons. And there still are cartoons, especially in the New Yorker magazine, long regarded as the high temple of the single-panel cartoon. Lots of people enjoy them. Some people admit not always getting the jokes. And our next guest draws them. Matthew Diffie got his first cartoon published in the New Yorker in 1999. Since then, he's published several books, including a series of cartoons that did not make it called The Rejection Collection. His latest is called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. Matt Diffie will be at the Eugene Library tomorrow at 2, and he's here now on The Exchange. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely good to have you. I was trying to relate to other people. It's hard to talk about cartoons on the radio, but things like a bunch of mean-looking guys riding across the desert on scooters that you called Vesperados.
Yeah. You can kind of picture it, though, can't you?
You really can. I really like the two German shepherds talking to each other, though, and the one says, you know, I'm really starting to like the smell of cocaine.
Yeah. Well, you have to mention that they're police German shepherds.
Of course, yeah. Important stuff. Yes. So you grew up in Texas, as I understand. Yep. You call yourself a Tex Yorker, but you live in L.A.
Yeah, I just moved to L.A. a few years ago, so okay. I apologize for that.
We understand. Is anybody in your birth family artistic or funny or both?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. My mom is very funny, sort of my biggest influence for writing and words and stories and stuff. And then my dad was a closet artist. He was an airline pilot, but was always painting and drawing and on his weekends.
But are you sure not during autopilot, during those moments in the cockpit?
He wasn't doing it at the sick, I guess you would say.
So do you remember when you started drawing cartoons, or is it something you've always been doing?
Well, I never wanted to be a cartoonist, oddly enough. I only did my first cartoon at the age of 29. I wanted to be a real artist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to be a comedian, and it was sort of failing at both of those things that I realized, oh, you could put the two together and be a cartoonist. So, yeah, I came to it pretty late, but was sort of working my way towards it in two different disciplines.
So I'm glad to hear that you like at least one Monty Python sketch. There's a whole generation of American men who you know, will live and die saying Monty Python words to their final days. So what were some of the other comedy influences of your life?
Oh, you know, Steve Martin was huge. Stephen Wright. Anyone named Steve, I guess. But those two guys are good examples. I think it couldn't be more different, but they're both very conceptual, I think. Even at Steve Martin's zaniest, there was always like a weird concept behind it that I really attached to. And then, you know, Stephen Wright is a perfect example of just sort of a, I don't know, clever one-liner kind of thing. And a little bit, you know, a little bit Monty Python in the sense that it's straight, kind of like serious.
Mm-hmm.
Presentation, which I think I try to do in my cartoons. It's, you know, I don't draw zany characters or wacky stuff. It's pretty serious drawing, and then the caption is in the concept, hopefully.
It is interesting how the funniest characters are often the ones that really don't intend to be funny, like Graham, what is his name now?
Which one?
In Monty Python, Graham...
Chapman.
Graham,
right?
Chapman, when he'd come on the screen and say, "Now that's silly, we're not going to do this anymore, it's silly."
Yeah.
And people would laugh at him more than anybody else. And then Stephen Wright coming on and saying, you know, it's a big world, but it's a small world.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want to paint it.
Paint it, right.
Stuff like that. So, yeah, all kinds of deadpan stuff that rings here. What subjects, then, do you tend to gravitate to in making cartoons?
Well, you know, Texas comes into it quite a lot. I do a bunch of sensitive or wimpy cowboy kind of cartoons. I try to bring, I guess, sometimes a rural southern sensibility. I guess just rural. And that's because one of my favorite cartoonists at the New Yorker is George Booth. You may know he does that sort of weird old couple and the dog.
There's always a dog with a really strange expression.
And then like the one light bulb hanging from a cord.
Right.
He sort of did that, and kind of I saw that, you can do country stuff even in the fancy city slicker New Yorker.
It is that. It is a city slicker thing, but, you know, all kinds of fun stuff in there. I do remember what I think is what got you into the New Yorker in the first place. It was that cartoon contest for the Algonquin, wasn't it?
Yeah. And that was way before. Now they do the caption contest, you know, where you just write the caption part to an existing drawing. This was before that existed, so you had to do all of it. You had to do the drawing and the caption. And I was, you know, like I said, failing at art and failing at comedy, so I was like, I can kind of do those two things if I mash them together. So I sent in a bunch of them and ended up being the finalist, or ended up being the winner of the contest. So that's how I met Bob Mankoff, who's the cartoon editor, which is a real job. And, you know, then I started submitting and sold pretty quick after that, and then had a couple years of paying my dues. And
did you have a big pile of cartoons that were ready for publication when you got that first one published in The New Yorker?
Not really. You know, like I said, I came to it late at 29, so I had to sort of ramp up my production. I had to do a lot of research as far as just The New Yorker, because, I mean, I grew up in Texas in a rural part, and not that we were bumpkins, but we didn't subscribe to The New Yorker, so I didn't, you know, maybe I saw them in a doctor's office or something, but, I, you know, for a couple hard weeks, I pored over all the old issues and all the old collections and learned what New Yorker cartoons were, and luckily it sort of meshed with my sensibility. And then just trying to figure out how to draw a cartoon that, you know, coming from more of a fine art background, I ended up drawing my cartoons in a little more realistic way than cartoony. And also it's why I put them in a square now, instead of a lot of cartoons just sort of drift into the white space of the page. And I like having the boundaries, because I come from a painting background where you're used to having the frame and the edge to sort of bounce your compositions off. So that's how I became a cartoonist that doesn't really draw like a cartoonist, I guess.
Matthew Diffie makes his cartoons available for The New Yorker, among other publications. He'll be in the Eugene Library tomorrow at 2 for free, it turns out. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange now at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You talked about the research. I mean, did you have any idea of the cultural significance of New Yorker cartoons when you're first gearing up to get in there? I mean, for example, the fact that Seinfeld even had an episode that dealt with New Yorker cartoons.
Yeah, I think I barely had it, had an idea, but I actually knew, you know, I was interested in comedy, so I knew more of the New Yorker as like short humor writing. And I have to be honest, I was kind of a cartoonist, like an art snob. I wasn't interested in being a cartoonist at all. I mean, I did like The Far Side. I remember that being really funny to me, and the fact that it was kind of cartoony drawing didn't bother me, but I didn't know a whole lot about the New Yorker cartoons until, yeah.
Have you gotten to rub shoulders with some of the other comedic talents of the New Yorker? Bruce McCulp in particular comes to mind, because he is both artist and funny writer as well.
I don't know Bruce, but we've been at the same parties. that's all I can say. But I have got to meet all my cartooning heroes, which is pretty amazing. You know, we're always kind of huddled over in the dark corner of the parties, keeping to ourselves and snickering and... So, yeah, it's been great.
So who's that, you and George Booth, and who else?
Me and George Booth, you know, Roz Chast will be over there giggling. Uh-huh. Some of my other fellow, you know, younger cronies, Drew Dernovich and Paul Noth, and, you know, the whole crowd, Mick Stevens, David Cypress, Jack Ziegler when he's in town.
Any of you guys tossing funny ideas around? Are you talking shop about technique or both or what?
Mainly we're just making fun of the other people, I guess, in the room, quietly.
That is
and just talking about how awkward we feel, mm-hmm. you know, these swanky New Yorker deals. We all take our cartoons into the editor. Or we used to. I used to when I lived in town. All the locals take them in on Tuesday morning, and that's when you really start talking shop. When, you know, we all go to lunch afterwards, and I say talk shop, but mainly it's complain. yeah, but you know, we do have very serious conversations about silly things like how to draw a porcupine so it doesn't look like a possum, or what the funniest name in a caption. You want a name that's sort of funny but not too funny.
Yeah, like Gary Larson was great with that, with the way he'd have deer named Hal and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Which makes it funnier than if the deer was named, you know, Bongo or something.
So talk about the creative process, and I've always been curious about this with cartoonists, is, you know, does the idea come first? Do the words that are going to be spoken come out, or does the picture come out and the words arrive later? How does that all work?
Well, it's interesting the way you ask that question. A lot of people just say, usually, is it the words or the pictures first? But you said, is it, you know, the idea or the concept, something. That's what I come up with, and I guess that's what all of us come up with. Just that spark, that sort of connection that makes it a joke. And some people get there by doodling, and they draw a guy, and then they see that he's got this kind of hat on, and then something comes out of it. I don't work that way. I work just with words. So I'm writing on a pad while I sip my morning coffee. And I'm just, whatever sort of comes into my mind, I start writing things, hoping to make some sort of connection. And while I'm writing, I'm visualizing the picture, but I just don't bother drawing until I have the concept. For me, the coming up of cartoons and the act of drawing are two different feelings in my mind. You know what I mean?
Sure. So
I can do one with music. I can draw with music playing, but I can't come up with jokes with music playing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Do the words get in the way, for example, from the music?
Yeah. So I have to have the concept. And, you know, like I say, just because I know how I'm going to draw it already, I'm already visualizing it. So it's, I guess it's just a shorthand for me just to write, you know, man in bar. I know exactly how I'm going to draw that.
So, Matt, do you end up with a couple of legal pads full of ideas and stuff and then go draw?
Yeah, I try to fill up a sheet of paper and empty a pot of coffee every morning. that's my job. And then at the end of the week, you know, I just set those ideas aside. And at the end of the week, when I need to come up with 10 for my submission to the New Yorker, which is crazy, right? 10 ideas that are sketched up. I just go through those pages, and now I'm looking at them with a few days, you know, distance, so I can pick out hopefully the ones that are still funny that weren't just funny that morning. Or, you know, and then I have the opportunity also of, like, seeing new opportunities in the joke. Like, oh, I almost had it, but this is better, actually. Hmm. And then I drop those 10 and send them in. And if I'm really, really lucky and really, really funny that week, I'll sell one.
Right, so they really require 10 at a time to be submitted to the
worker? Yeah, that's the sort of unwritten, I mean, it's been spoken. Mm-hmm. That's the rule, I guess, yeah.
So have you had ever, like, you know, 4 of 10 or 5 of 10?
I've sold 2 of 10 once, maybe 5 times in my whole 16 years of doing it. It does happen, but it's very rare. There's so many cartoons coming in from so many great cartoonists.
No doubt. We're talking to Matthew Diffie, who is a cartoonist who gets published on a regular basis in The New Yorker. But as you hear, it takes a lot of effort to get one cartoon in there. You can join us on The Exchange in the few minutes we have left. 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. He'll be at the Eugene Library tomorrow at 2. So Bob Mankoff, does he ever look at the cartoons with you in the room, the New Yorker cartoon, when you were in New York, obviously, but I mean...
Yeah. Yeah, when we all go into the office, we all sort of stand around clutching our, you know, little stack of cartoons, and then we go in one by one, sit across the desk from him, and he starts rifling through them, and at the same time saying, "Yeah, how's your week been? Okay, great. How you doing?" And then, you know, he of course never laughs, but he'll take a couple out of the stack, and say, "I'll keep these." And what he means by that is he'll take those into the next round of evaluations to determine which cartoons he takes to David Remnick, who is the editor of the magazine, who makes the final call. At least that's what Bob says. I think Bob has more more sway, but Bob's a cartoonist also, so I think he tries to protect himself from being blamed.
No doubt.
My personal theory.
Yeah, I do remember seeing this process on the 60 Minutes piece about the New Yorker cartoons about Bob Mankoff and David Remnick in the room and everything. So when you look at the stuff though that got kicked out that didn't go into the New Yorker, I mean, you've obviously made 3 volumes of the rejection collection out of this now. I mean, there's some in there that you think were just brilliant and should have run.
Well, the rejection collection is a very specific thing. Those are ones that we did, and it's not just my work, it's, you know, 30 or something of us. It's work that we did, and we kind of knew it was inappropriate for The New Yorker because it's too outrageous or too raunchy or something. So those are a different thing. We hand-selected stuff that we knew was not right for The New Yorker, would never sell to The New Yorker, because some of your other ideas that get rejected just because there's so many cartoons coming in that week and so little space, sometimes we can bring those back, you know, a year later or 3 years later, and they'll sell. But these are ones that we knew, they're never going to do that.
Ah. What does the New Yorker pay for a cartoon?
It's between $570,000. No.
Carefully.
If you're selling regularly, you can have a good living, being independent, doing your creative work, which is the best, as long as you don't try to do it in an expensive city.
Ah. And that explains why you're living in, and actually you're in L.A. now,
right.
So that's fairly expensive, isn't it?
Fairly expensive, but I have a wife that has a job, so that helps.
Mm-hmm.
And my needs are simple.
Good to know. So, I mean, so it's a living, but it's a living with another income in the house.
Usually, yeah. Or a lot of other cartoonists will teach, or they'll do illustration on the side, or exotic dancing, whatever they have to do to get a second income.
Is Matt Diffie on the headline at some exotic dancing establishment in L.A.?
We would be the worst exotic dancing review cartoonist of the New Yorker.
I think we have an idea for a sketch here, don't you?
Yeah, maybe so.
So there's a piece in Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People, your new book, and the title alone is bound to get some people annoyed with you. But is it true that your doctor tried out his comedy material on you?
No, not true.
Oh,
darn. Not true, but it would be funny if he did. Yeah, I did. I got to do, in the book, I got to do some, you know, multi-panel cartooning instead of just the one that they give you in The New Yorker. So sort of a jokey sketch situation in a doctor's office, which is hilarious. And you should also buy the book to see what it
is really funny. So so winning the Reuben Award, this is like winning an Oscar for a cartoonist, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. People always think it's a sandwich. Like, oh, you won a Reuben? Huh. I get those every weekend at the Wonder Deli. But yeah, it's the National Cartoonist Society, which has been around forever, and they give out awards every year. And it is very similar to the Oscars, except it's a room full of cartoonists in tuxedos instead of the Hollywood elite.
So no red carpet arrivals?
Yeah, but you know, there's some huge heavy hitters in there, so that's a pretty big thrill to be part of that organization.
I can imagine.
I'm actually the chairman of the Los Angeles chapter.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal, I have to say. We're pretty big shots.
So, you know, just from the few minutes of you on video I got to see from your website, I mean, it's clear you can be pretty funny in person. I mean, were you actually trying as a stand-up comic? And when you said you tried comedy, it wasn't working. Was that
the... Yeah, I tried stand-up comedy for years. And you know, to be honest, it worked sometimes. It all depending on how it started. If it started well and the people thought I was funny, I would do real well. And if there was a little awkwardness, because I'm not a natural performer... sometimes there'd be a little bit of an awkwardness. And sometimes comedy clubs, they just expect a level of aggression, I think, from the performer. And I just don't like doing that. I'm not good at it. So, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it wouldn't. So now is my chance to actually do some of that I you know, always wanted to do. But it's always great to show the cartoons up there because people are looking at the cartoons and there's that ripe sort of moment before you deliver the caption like a joke and then you can riff off of it and... just have fun with people in the audience. I love doing performance stuff.
Well, it sounds good. People will enjoy tomorrow at the 2 at the Eugene Library. Matthew Diffie is a cartoonist who's gotten published in The New Yorker many times. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was fun.
All right, take care.